The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30.
Time for our weekly environment spot with John Gibbons. And John, let's start with some good news. The establishment of a new national park, our eighth in the country, in the Cork Duvna Peninsula in West Kerry, is going to cover more than 70,000 acres. Most of it at sea, making it the largest national park in the country, our first marine national park, and also including the wonderful, magnificent Connor Pass and its 1,400 acres of land and forestry. What's not to like about this, John?
Good evening, Matt. Yeah, it's always good to start with some good news, and it certainly reads that way. But looking a little bit more closely into it, the first thing to say is that we don't really have a clear legal definition in Ireland of what a national park actually is. You know, when you say national park, people immediately think of, for example, Yosemite in the US, this pristine national park where wildlife thrive and where you can see basically nature as it was in its primordial sense, where wolves roam freely and basically where humans kind of, other than for a little bit of tourism, humans basically stay out of these great national parks like Yosemite. Irish national parks are very different. Basically, Irish national parks, if you were to walk through an Irish national park, you wouldn't know that you're in it because effectively it'll look exactly like the farmed land to the left and right of it, because essentially all of these parks are also open to basically the local farmers operate them, work through them, and so on. So, for example,
why not? Is that not putting them to good use? I mean, this particular new national park as well, I didn't give the full details of what's involved in it. It has the catchment of the Owenmore River, which is an 8-kilometre waterway with 9 lakes, utterly spectacular to look at. They can be non-minded by the state. You have Mount Brandon. You've got those wonderful sand dunes at Inch Beach. You've got the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Skellig Michael. You have several more islands off the Kerry coastline as well as the sea surrounding them. That these are things now that can be taken in care by the state.
Well, that, again, in theory, would be brilliant if that was what was going to happen. But the first thing that Malcolm Noonan, the responsible minister, said when making this announcement is that essentially there would be no changes in existing farming practices in this new national park or in any of the national parks. That means, for example, many of our national parks are highly degraded. They're, for example, our Killarney National Park is severely degraded from overgrazing, from deer, from feral goats, and of course from sheep, right? Now, if we're going to continue those practices in our new national park, effectively it becomes, Matt, what's called a paper park. In other words, it's a line on a map, but it has no gained ecological value. Let me go back to my Yosemite analogy, right? If the cattle ranchers of the Midwest decided, in fact, that Yosemite should also be a cattle run and there should be hundreds of thousands of cattle in Yosemite, okay, fine, that they would do that. But the problem with that, of course, is that the wildlife in Yosemite would, of course, decline, because that's how it works. Essentially, if you've heavily farmed land, well, then there's no space for wild nature. Now, of course, there's lots of space for farming in Ireland. We have vast amounts of Ireland is already given over to farmland. But I suspect that when you introduced this segment, immediately your listeners had an idea in their mind of a national park being a special place, a place that is protected, a place that is not overgrazed, a place where wild nature is given a chance to recover. And I'm afraid they'd be sorely disappointed, Matt. For example, we have a great national park up in Wicklow, and I'm sure you and many of your listeners have driven through there. Essentially, it's like a moonscape up there. There's nothing. It's overgrazed again by deer and by sheep, which means the natural vegetation of our uplands, which would be deciduous uplands rising into natural forest, there is nothing up there. It's all grazed down to the ground. And so, in a sense, you could say, great, we've got this fantastic national park up in Wicklow, drive up through it, and what you're looking at is a moonscape. There's nothing much. And again, if you put on your ecology goggles and say, well, okay, what is the value? What is the ecological value? Have we an intact ecosystem going on here, providing ecosystem services? And the answer, by and large, is no. So this is really the issue, is that it's wonderful to have designation of national park, but the question really is, what exactly does it mean? Again, the Parks and Wildlife Service, they've made a promise to bring forward legislation that would define a national park and create the powers for the Parks and Wildlife Service to enforce it. But at the moment, even the Parks and Wildlife Service don't know what we mean when they say national park. Right. So therefore, I come back to my original point. A national park in Ireland at the moment is indistinguishable between a heavily grazed upland to the left and a heavily grazed upland to the right. So I think people would expect more. And there is another point probably about this as well, Matt. When you designate something a national park, people obviously will flock to it. So you get additional pressure of tourism, building new roads, giving more tourist access. So you can have the great irony that unless you change the use designation, in other words, that you limit access for grazers, which include wild deer and farm sheep, unless you limit their access to it, you could end up in 10 years' time with the Conor Pass in worse condition than it is today. And that's really something we don't want to be spending our money. And the question really is, if we're putting millions into buying these, which, by the way, I'm totally in favour of, unless the designation national park means something, well, then, again, all we're doing is creating lines on maps.
Okay, right. Tell us, so please, about what's happening in Canada, a proposed global treaty to reduce plastic pollution.
That's right, Matt. Well, first of all, at the moment, over the last 20 years, globally, we've about doubled plastics production. So about 460 million tons of plastic were produced last year. Now, that's on track, on our current trajectory, to treble, to rise to over a billion tons of plastics a year. So, of course, 460 million tons translates into trillions of individual pieces of plastic, because obviously plastic by definition is very light. So you're talking about a vast amount of plastic. It's probably important to say that globally, at best, they reckon that maybe 9% of all the plastic that is produced every year is ever recycled. Much of it, of course, makes its way into the natural environment, into our waterways, into our oceans. Much of it is landfilled. More is burned in incinerators. So basically, what we have is a rapidly accumulating problem globally with plastics. It's accumulating. We know, for example, it's now been detected in the bloodstreams of unborn infants. That's how pervasive plastics have become in our modern world.
But I also see that survey as well, Fionn. There are 60 global companies who are responsible for half of the world's plastic pollution, and indeed six are responsible for a quarter of that. So you've got companies like Philip Morris International, Danone, Nestle, PepsiCo and Coca-Cola amongst the worst offenders. But what's the alternative to the use of the plastic?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, the only alternative, Matt, to this is that we have to challenge the throwaway culture. We're surrounded by a throwaway culture. And this, by the way, is new. I mean, the throwaway coffee cup, the throwaway Coke bottle, all of this is new. And this is something that...
Sorry, my Coke bottle that I have sitting beside me at the moment says it's made out of recycled plastic.
Well, it must be a very special Coke bottle if that's the case, because globally...
Sorry, it says, I'm a bottle made from 100% recycled plastic.
Sure, yeah. But again, globally, Matt, you look at the numbers for Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, their recycling rates globally are atrociously low. So you obviously have got one of a very limited number of fully recycled plastic.
I don't know about that, because it also says on the bottle, recycle me again.
Yeah, and again, there's a limit to how many times you can recycle plastic, because it degrades along the way through various actions. But the key thing here really is the only possible solution to this is to challenge the throwaway culture, the chuck everything in the bin, chuck it out. And unfortunately, the corporations that you've just described, they're some of the wealthiest organizations in the world. They haven't the slightest intention of slowing this process down. And what we have really, and we see it, for example, in some of our national recycling programs, like here with Repack in Ireland, these are industry-driven programs, and their focus is on recycling. There's no attempt at reducing use, no attempt at reusing products. Everything is pushed on recycling. And this is very much an industry meme. They don't want to talk about use reduction. They do not want to talk about reuse. What they want to talk instead about is recycling, because it sounds good. But as I say, at best, Matt, 9% of the virgin plastic that is introduced into the atmosphere or into the environment every year, at best, 9% that is ever recovered in any way. That means over 90% of it becomes pervasive plastic pollution. And plastic, for all intents and purposes, you know, once it's produced, will continue to be an environmental toxin for hundreds, if not thousands of years into the future.
Okay, let's finish on a positive note. Tell us about the call for a special climate tax on billionaires, the people who are really wealthy, who can afford these measures rather than the ordinary consumers.
Absolutely, yeah. This has been put forward by a Nobel-winning economist called Esther Duflo, and she has pitched this idea of a 2% wealth tax, which isn't a lot really, on the world's top 3,000 billionaires. And she reckons that action alone would raise $400 billion a year for what's called loss, damage and adaptation. And her, and this isn't obviously a brand new idea. People like Piketty, the economist, have proposed wealth taxes before. The difference with her pitch is that she's saying that the hyper-consumption of the super wealthy is accelerating climate change. Therefore, they should be making direct cash transfers to people in poorer countries to help them with the impacts of the climate crisis that is being fueled by overconsumption by the super rich. So it basically, what we're looking at here really is climate justice and environmental equity measure. To give a small example to your listeners.
Quickly, Jeff please.
Bezos, yeah, very quickly, yeah. Jeff Bezos last year earned $7.9 million an hour, which works out that he earns the lifetime income, Matt, of the regular person about every 13 minutes. And really, that's a world that none of us can afford. It's not sustainable.
Thank you very much, Sean Gibbons. And thank you to the listener who says Corcuguina is the correct pronunciation of the area covered by the new national park.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.